to see. She simply kissed him and hurried back for evening sign-in at the dormitory. James himself began to forget about the cowlick. After Marilyn left, he seldom remembered to look in the mirror. Every time she kissed him, every time he opened his arms and she crawled into them, felt like a miracle. Coming to her made him feel perfectly welcomed, perfectly at home, as he had never in his life felt before. He had never felt he belonged here, even though he'd been born on American soil, even though he had never set foot anywhere else. His father had come to California under a false name, pretending to be the son of a neighbor who had emigrated there some years earlier. America was a melting pot. But Congress, terrified that the molten mixture was becoming a shade too yellow, had banned all immigrants from China. Only the children of those already in the States could enter. So James's father had taken the name of his neighbor's son, who had drowned in the river the year before, and come to join his father in San Francisco. It was the story of nearly every Chinese immigrant from the time of Chester A. Arthur to the end of the Second World War. While the Irish and the Germans and the Swedes crowded onto steamship decks, waving as the pale green torch of the Statue of Liberty came into view, the coolies had to find other means to reach the land where all men were created equal. Those who made it would visit their wives in China and return each time celebrating the birth of a son. Those at home in the villages who longed to make their fortunes would adopt the names of those mythical sons and make the long journey across the sea. While the Norwegians and the Italians and the Russian Jews ferried from Ellis Island to Manhattan, fanning out by road and railway to Kansas and Nebraska and Minnesota, the Chinese who bluffed their way to California mostly stayed put. In Chinatowns, the lives of all those paper sons were fragile and easily torn. Everyone's name was false. Everyone hoped not to be found out and sent back. Everyone clustered together so they wouldn't stand out. James's parents, however, had not stayed put. In 1938, when James was six, his father received a letter from a paper brother who had gone east looking for work when the Depression began. He had found a place at a small boarding school in Iowa, the brother wrote, doing grounds work and maintenance. Now his real, non-paper mother was ill, and he was returning to China, and his employers wondered if he had any reliable friends who might do as good a job. They like the Chinese, the letter said. They feel we are quiet and hard-working and clean. It was a good position, a very exclusive school. There might be a job for his wife in the school kitchens. Would he be interested? James could not read Chinese, but all his life he held the memory of the letter's last paragraph, a scrawl of fountain pen calligraphy which caught his parents' attention. There was a special policy, said the brother, for children of employees. If they could pass an entrance exam, they could attend the school for free. Jobs were scarce and everyone was hungry. But it was because of this paragraph that the Lees sold their furniture and moved across the country with two suitcases between them. It took 5 Greyhound rides and 4 days. When they reached Iowa, James's uncle took them to his apartment. James remembered only the man's teeth, more crooked even than his father's, one tooth turned sideways, like a sliver of rice waiting to be toothpicked out. The next day, his father put on his best shirt, buttoned up to the collar, and went with his friend to Lloyd Academy. By afternoon, it was settled. He would start the following week. The morning after that, his mother put on her best dress and went with his father to the school. That evening, Each brought home a navy blue uniform stitched with a new English name. Henry. Wendy. A few weeks later, James's parents brought him to Lloyd for the entrance exam. A man with a large white mustache like cotton brought him into an empty classroom and gave him a booklet and a yellow pencil. Looking back, James realized what a brilliant idea it was. What 6-year-old would be able to read, let alone pass such an exam? A teacher's son, perhaps, if she had studied with him. Surely not a janitor's son, or a cafeteria lady's son, or a groundskeeper's son. If a square playing field is 40 feet on a side, how long is the fence that goes around it? When was America discovered? Which of these words is a noun? Here is a sequence of shapes. Which shape completes the pattern? We're sorry, the principal could say. Your son didn't pass the test. He isn't up to Lloyd academic standards, and no tuition would be necessary. James, though, had known all the answers. He had read every newspaper he could get his hands on. He had read all the books his father had bought, a nickel a bag at library book sales. 160 feet, he wrote. 1492. Automobile. The circle. He finished the test and set the pencil in the slot at the top of the desk. The man with the mustache didn't look up until 20 minutes later. Finished already? He said. You were so quiet, sonny. He took away the booklet and the pencil and brought James back to the kitchens, where his mother was working. I'll grade the test and let you know the results next week, he told them. But James already knew he had passed. When the term began in September, he rode into school with his father in the Ford truck the school had lent him for his maintenance work. You're the first Oriental boy to attend Lloyd, his father reminded him. Set a good example. That first morning, James slid into his seat and the girl next to him asked, What's wrong with your eyes? It wasn't until he heard the horror in the teacher's voice, Shirley Byron, that he realized he was supposed to be embarrassed. The next time it happened, he had learned his lesson and turned red right away. In every class, every day that first week, the other students studied him. Where had he come from, this boy? He had a book bag, a Lloyd uniform. Yet he didn't live at the school like the rest of them. He looked like no one they'd ever seen. Now and then, his father would be called in to loosen a squeaky window, replace a light bulb, mop up a spill. James, scrunched in the back row, saw his classmates glance from his father to him and knew that they suspected. He would bend his head over his book, so close that his nose nearly touched the page until his father left the room. By the second month, he asked his parents for permission to walk to and from school by himself. Alone, he could pretend to be just another student. He could pretend that, in the uniform, he looked just like everyone else. He spent 12 years at Lloyd and never felt at home. At Lloyd, everyone seemed to be descended from a pilgrim or a senator or a Rockefeller. But when they did family tree projects in class, he pretended to forget the assignment rather than draw his own complicated diagram. Don't ask any questions, he prayed silently as the teacher marked a small red 0 beside his name. He set himself a curriculum of studying American culture, listening to the radio, reading comics, saving his pocket money for double features, learning the rules of the new board games, in case anyone ever said, Hey, did you hear Red Skelton yesterday? Or, Wanna play Monopoly? Though no one ever did. As he got older, he did not attend the dances, or the pep rallies, or the junior or senior proms. At best, girls smiled silently at him in the hallways. At worst, they stared as he passed and he heard their snickers as he turned the corner. At graduation, the yearbook ran one photo of him besides the obligatory senior portrait. A shot of him at an assembly to greet President Truman, his head visible over the shoulder of the class treasurer and a girl who would go on to marry a Belgian prince. His ears, blushing pink in real life, were a deep and unnatural gray in the photograph, his mouth slightly open, as if he had been caught trespassing. At college, he hoped things would be different. Yet after 7 years at Harvard, 4 as an undergrad, 3 and counting as a graduate student, nothing had changed. Without realizing why, he studied the most quintessentially American subject he could find, cowboys. But he never spoke of his parents or his family. He still had few acquaintances and no friends. He still found himself shifting in his seat, as if at any moment someone might notice him and ask him to leave. So that fall of 1957, when Marilyn had leaned over his desk and kissed him, this beautiful, honey-haired girl, when she came into his arms and then into his bed, James could not quite believe it. The first afternoon they'd spent together, in his tiny, whitewashed studio apartment, he marveled at how her body fit so perfectly against his. Her nose nestled exactly into the hollow between his collarbones, her cheek curved to match the side of his neck, as if they were two halves of a mold. He had studied her with the air of a sculptor, tracing the contours of her hips and calves, his fingertips grazing her skin. When they made love, her hair came alive. It darkened from golden wheat to amber. It kinked and curled like a fiddlehead fern. It amazed him that he could have such an effect on anyone. As she dozed in his arms, her hair slowly relaxed, and when she woke, it had stretched back to its usual waves. Then her easy laugh sparkled in that white, bare room, as she chattered, breathless. Her hands fluttered until he caught them in his, and they lay warm and still like resting birds. And then she pulled him to her again. It was as if America herself was taking him in. It was too much luck. He feared the day the universe would notice he wasn't supposed to have her and take her away, or that she might suddenly realize her mistake and disappear from his life as suddenly as she had entered. After a while, the fear became a habit, too. He began to make small changes he thought she might like. He trimmed his hair. He bought a blue-striped Oxford shirt after she admired one on a passerby. The cowlick, persistent, still stood up. Years later, Nath and Hannah would inherit it, too. One Saturday, at Marilyn's suggestion, he bought 2 gallons of pale yellow paint, pushed the furniture to the middle of the apartment, and spread drop cloths across the parquet. As they brushed one section, then another, the room brightened like panes of sunlight stretching across the walls. When everything was painted, they opened all the windows and curled up on the bed in the center of the room. The apartment was so small that nothing was more than a few feet from the wall. But surrounded by his desk and chairs, the armchair and the dresser pressed close, he felt as if they were on an island or afloat in the sea. With Marilyn tucked in the curve of his shoulder, he kissed her and her arms circled his neck. Her body rose to meet his. Another tiny miracle. Every time. Later that afternoon, waking in the fading light, he noticed a tiny yellow blotch on the tip of Marilyn's toe. After a moment of searching, he found a smudge on the wall near the end of the bed, where her foot had touched it as they made love. A dime-sized spot where the paint was blotted away. He said nothing to Marilyn. And when they pushed the furniture back into place that evening, the dresser concealed the smudge. Every time he looked at that dresser, he was pleased, as if he could see through the pine drawers and his folded clothing straight to it, that mark her body had left in his space. At Thanksgiving, Marilyn decided not to go home to Virginia. She told herself and James that it was too far for such a short holiday. But in reality, she knew her mother would ask her again if she had any prospects. And this time, she did not know how to respond. Instead, in James's tiny kitchen, she roasted a chicken, cubed potatoes, peeled yams into a casserole dish the size of a steno pad. Thanksgiving dinner in miniature. James, who had never cooked himself a meal, who subsisted on burgers from Charlie's Kitchen and English muffins from the Hayes Bickford, watched in awe. After Marilyn basted the chicken, she looked up defiantly, closed the oven, and peeled the oven mitts from her hands. "My mother is a home economics teacher," she said. "Betty Crocker is her personal goddess." It was the first thing she had told him about her mother. The way she said it, it sounded like a secret, something she had kept hidden and now, deliberately, trustingly, revealed. James felt he should return this privilege, this private gift. He had mentioned once, in passing, that his parents had worked at a school, leaving it at that, hoping she'd think, teacher. But he had never told her how the school kitchen had been like the land of the giants. Everything economy-sized. Rolls of tinfoil half a mile long. Jars of mayonnaise big enough to hold his head. His mother was in charge of bringing the world down to scale, chopping melons into dice-sized cubes, portioning pats of butter onto saucers to accompany each roll. He had never told anyone how the other kitchen ladies snickered at his mother for wrapping up the leftover food instead of throwing it away. How at home they'd reheat it in the oven while his parents quizzed him. "What did you do in geography? What did you do in math?" And he'd recite, "Montgomery is the capital of Alabama. Prime numbers have only two factors." They didn't understand his answers, but they'd nodded, pleased that James was learning things they did not know. As they spoke, he would crumble crackers into a cup of celery soup, or peel waxed paper from a wedge of cheese sandwich, and pause, confused, certain he'd done this before, uncertain whether he was reviewing his studies or the whole school day. In the fifth grade, he had stopped speaking Chinese to his parents, afraid of tinting his English with an accent. Long before that, he had stopped speaking to his parents at school at all. He was afraid to tell Marilyn these things. Afraid that once he admitted them, she would see him as he had always seen himself. A scrawny outcast, feeding on scraps, reciting his lines and trying to pass. An imposter. He was afraid she would never see him any other way. "My parents are both dead," he said. "They died just after I started college." His mother had died his second year, a tumor blossoming in her brain. His father had gone 6 months later. Complications of pneumonia, the doctors had said. But James had known the truth. His father simply hadn't wanted to live alone. Marilyn didn't say anything. But she reached out and cupped his face in her hands, and James felt the leftover heat from the oven in her soft palms. They were there only a moment before the timer buzzed and she turned back to the stove, but they warmed him through, He remembered his mother's hands, scarred from steam burns, calloused from scouring pots, and wanted to press his lips to the tender hollow where Marilyn's lifeline and love line crossed.